Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today. It's another midday town hall with Governor Wes Moore. We'll spend the hour talking with the governor about his legislative agenda in the General Assembly and his new 10-year state plan that includes initiatives around public safety, ending poverty, housing, and many other issues. Over the past week or so, we've collected a number of questions for the governor from listeners via email and on our listener line. If you have an issue that you'd like to raise with Governor Moore during the show today, you can drop us an email, the address midday@wipr.org. Governor Moore joins us on Zoom from his office in Annapolis. Governor, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you, too. Good afternoon.
So, of course, Governor, full disclosure, you are no stranger to WIPR in that weird, deep, dark period before you were governor. You actually hosted a show here called Future City, and it seems like 100 years ago, but it was actually just, you know, a year and a half ago or so.
That's right.
And I want to talk about the 10-year state plan that you announced a week or two ago. It's going to be overseen by something called the Office of Performance Improvement. What is it and why is it important?
Yeah, you know, it was really important because you have to be able to actually have data to be able to determine your direction. You know, I think that, you know, one of the things that we have found as a state is we just have not been accountable. We haven't really been able to really have our agencies working in the same levels, working for the same goals. And to be frank, you know, we found the muscle of data-driven governance had atrophied at some agencies over the past decade. And there was just a lack of data, a lack of information, but there was a base of data that we could start building from and we could evolve from there. And so what we really wanted to do is say, what were the bigger goals that we had for an administration? And then what becomes the role of every single agency, every single department, and also every single state employee to know that they should have a measurement of ownership so we can determine what success looks like, what are the metrics that we're gonna gauge, and then have our decisions really being able to help to track that. And so we're able to track things like, for example, we're tracking the number of people who are experiencing homelessness, but also tracking the number of affordable housing units, preserved and developing and using state and federal resources. We're tracking the number of behavioral health providers and a follow-up after someone visits the ER for an issue that's related to mental health. So we can actually give metrics on where the state is, how can the state improve, and what are the things that we need to put in place in order to see that improvement. And, you know, I'm thankful that we've already started to see specifically on things like economics, that certain measurements are already moving in the state of Maryland. We just want to make sure that everything within the state, that we can be data driven and heart led in the way that we do our work.
And you have a number of priorities involved in the state plan: child poverty, education, the economy, job creation, public safety, a number of things. Of course, all that takes revenue. And revenue is very much top of mind in the legislature this session and these last couple of weeks. There was even a proposal that's starting to get some attention from Delegate David Moon about changing the scope of the sales tax in Maryland to include services that are currently not taxed, like, you know, landscaping or accounting, that kind of thing. What's your take on the state of revenue for the state of Maryland and the need for revenue enhancements in this session this year?
Yeah, you know, and I completely understand the frustration for a lot of people, because part of the problem is that our economy hasn't been growing. You know, over the past 5 years, Maryland's economy has grown by 0.2%. The average state in this country has grown by 7.5%. So our economy is not just sluggish. Our economy essentially had been stalled for a long period of time. And so when it's very difficult to have grand aspirations and bold visions, but you're not having a growing economy that can do a better job of supporting it. And it goes back to the idea that, you know, there was no structural surplus that we inherited. That was one-time money. That was one-time money that came from the Biden administration for COVID. And by the way, by the time that I was sworn in as governor, much of that money was already earmarked. So there's this myth that we somehow had this massive structural surplus, and where'd all the money go? There, you know, over the last 20 state budgets, Maryland has needed cuts to stay balanced in 17 of them. That's the reality. And again, that's not politics, that's math. And so we decided that we had to come in and do things that could get our economy going. We had to be able to create measurements of GDP and economic growth within the economy, but we could not do it on the backs of working families. And so I'm proud of the fact that we're taking this issue head on. And by the way, I want to be clear, we're not the only state that's dealing with this. I mean, Indiana is facing a $500 million structural deficit. New Jersey's facing $1 billion. Michigan is at $4 billion. California, I think, is at $34 billion of a structural deficit. So states around the country are dealing with the fact that the COVID money just isn't there anymore. And we're just having to find ways of being bold and creative, but do it without the influx of federal dollars. And so when you think about the budget that we have on board, our budget does things like making the largest investments in childcare in our state's history. Our budget has things like making investments in housing and dealing with the issue of affordable housing and increasing the amount of units by working on permitting and fees and working with permitting and regulations and working with our local jurisdictions. Our budget does things like making historic investments both in education and also in local law enforcement to be able to do the issue of public safety. But I also know that the my bar for the issue of taxes is very, very high. The budget we propose actually shows that we can do all these bold things and not raise taxes. And so I don't look at taxes. I know in the past, in Maryland's recent history, taxes have been more of an ideology. I don't view them that way. We are going to work with the legislature. I'm going to consistently look at the numbers and look at the data. That's what we do. But I also know that the bar for me is very, very high when it comes to taxes on working families.
It's a midday town hall with Governor Wes Moore. I'm Tom Hall. Our email address, if you have a question or comment for the governor, midday@wypr.org. So, Governor, if the economy is growing as sluggishly as you say, we still have an unemployment rate that's incredible. I mean, it's like 2.2% for the month of February. And for a while, it was even under 2% for certainly the Baltimore metro region. How do you grow an economy when virtually, statistically, everybody's working?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's amazing, Tom. And I think it's one of the things we've really been focusing on. When we first came on board, Maryland was 43rd in the country in unemployment. And so when we came on board, we said we've got to do things to get people back into the economy. And that's why we made strategic decisions. We made decisions like focusing on apprenticeship programs and trade programs and removing barriers for people to need college degrees or things that we found to be arbitrary in some of the skill sets that they were looking for. And made it show so that we were going to invest in our four-year colleges, but we were going to end this myth that every single one of our students need to attend one in order to be economically successful. We became the first state in the country that has a service year option for all of our high school graduates and providing pathways for individuals who with high school degrees or high school equivalencies to enter into the workforce, that we're able to invest in childcare. And specifically why that matters is it helps to get women back into the workforce. We were able to do things like raising a minimum wage and so get rid of the days where we were disincentivizing work and get people back into the workforce. So we've been very excited to see that the progress that we've been able to make is real. To your point, Tom, you know, we've gone from 43rd in the country in unemployment to now having five straight months of some of the lowest unemployment rates in the entire country. What we have to do, though, is continue to focus on things like labor participation, continue to provide incentives for people to come back into the workforce, specifically making it easier and that's why we have bills that are in the legislature right now, focusing on things like permitting reform and regulatory reform, making it easier for our small businesses and our minority-owned businesses and our women-owned businesses to be able to grow and hire, and providing more pathways for people to be able to enter into the workforce. So we're excited about the momentum that we're seeing around the state of Maryland. It's just also we're not done because we have to make sure that we're getting people back to work, that we're incentivizing work, and we're making the pathways easier for people to be able to not just enter but stay in the workforce.
The Senate Budget Committee did put a bill on the floor a day or two ago that does not include new taxes. I happened to be speaking with Senator Sarah Elfrith yesterday. She's running for Congress. That's what we were talking about mostly. But she, of course, sits on the Budget Committee in the Senate. And she mentioned the possibility, and it sounded like the likelihood, of some fees going up. She downplayed how many and the extent and significance of the increases, saying some of these fees hadn't been raised in 20 years, et cetera. But do you see that as a probability? I mean, we've got a Board of Revenue estimates that last week on Thursday revised what they had said the revenue for the state would be in 2024 and 2025. And the estimate was revised downward by a lot, more than $250 million. So does that money come from an increase in fees and that kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, watching what happened with the BRE, the Board of Revenue Estimates, it is an example of why we've got to focus on getting this economy moving and the reliance that we've had on the federal government, the reliance we've had on federal dollars. That can't continue. It's the reason that we have to do things like diversify our economy and why we put in legislation this year to address things like industries of the future, that Maryland is and needs to be the cyber capital of this country, that we have to invest in things like data centers and have to invest in quantum computing and also all these industries that can allow more pathways, advanced manufacturing, that can allow more people to enter into that workforce and allow Maryland to take its rightful place as a national leader within these industries. I know that part of the reason that we're having the conversation with the General Assembly on issues of user fees is it's true. We went 8 years where, again, any conversation around either taxes or user fees, it was really guided by a political philosophy and not by an economic one. It was an ideology, and it wasn't using data to be able to make the decisions. And so it's important that we now use data and not look at this from a political ideology about how we're thinking about it. And conversations about user fees and that type of thing, I think these are important conversations to have because you have to come up with ways of being able to support your ambitions. I just know, and I've been very clear with the legislature, that that my bar is just very, very high when it comes to how we're thinking about that work.
And does that high bar include things like a sales tax change? As opposed to an income tax? Obviously, the bar is high for income tax, but are sales tax and those fees, et cetera, in that same same realm of distaste for you?
Yeah, we're going to continue working with them on it. I just know that also taxes, particularly ones that are going to hit working families, as I'm looking at the data, I don't see a need for us to raise taxes in this moment, just looking at the data that we have presented in front of us. But any of those conversations and any of the negotiations that we're having right now with both the Senate and the House, they know and they will continue to hear from us that I just have a very, very high bar as to what that's going to look like.
It's a midday town hall with Governor Wes Moore. We'll have more with the governor on the other side of a quick break. If you'd like to be part of our town hall, you can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. When we come back, we'll talk about juvenile justice. We'll talk about housing. We'll talk about transportation. We'll talk about the issues that matter most to Marylanders. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about a couple of juvenile justice bills that have passed both the House and the Senate in the General Assembly. They're different bills in each part of the General Assembly, and we'll talk about what it's going to take to get them together to get to the governor's desk. We'll talk with Delegate Luke Klippinger. He's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, about the differences between the House and Senate versions of the bills. Plus, former federal judge and Baltimore City Solicitor Andre Davis and James Dold of Human Rights for Kids will share their perspective about what approach to kids and crime makes the most sense. So that's coming up tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, it's a midday town hall with Governor Wes Moore. The governor's taking questions from listeners and from me about a range of issues. If you have something you'd like to bring up with Governor Moore, midday at WIPR.org is our email. So, Governor, let's talk about the juvenile justice legislation that's in front of both the House and the Senate. They've got to come to a compromise before something ends up on your desk, as I just mentioned. Rachel Bay, who covers the State House for us here at WIPR, has a question. It says, research shows that charging kids as adults is counterproductive, making them more likely to reoffend. On average, roughly 700 teens are charged as adults each year in Maryland as a result of the law that requires them to be charged as adults if they're accused of certain crimes. The vast majority of them are young Black children. Is this law a problem? This is, you know, being a child with handcuffs on is something you know a lot about. What needs to happen with juvenile justice in this year's session?
Yeah, you know, it's true, Tom. I mean, this is personal for me, right? I mean, I was 11 years old when I had handcuffs on my wrist, and I know that when I first went through the process of running, you know, and in fact, during my inaugural address, I said, you know, we can be a state that centers and focuses on accountability and at the same time address the untenable reality that Maryland arrests, you know, more Black males and Black children between the ages of 18 and 25 than anyone else in the country, with the exception of and number two is Mississippi. So we can be a society that can deal with both of those two realities, knowing that we have to deal with measurements of accountability. There have to be consequences for actions. And at the same time, we're never going to militarize our way out of something that's also a much bigger and structural problem. And, you know, I think it was important that we actually work with the legislature on this. You know, I always said I would never be a governor and this would never be an administration that where I was just demand that the legislature does this or call on the legislature to do that, but then not actually work with them to be able to get something done. And so we've actually made the active choice to work with the legislature. And I told them that that, you know, the hallmarks and really the North Star that I had on this was going to be on accountability. Accountability both for the, you know, the individuals, and that includes children who happen to break the law, but also it means accountability for the system. Because when, you know, when we entered office, you know, about 13 months ago, there was a real measure of brokenness in the Department of Juvenile Services, and leaders from both parties and community members across the state just shared a frustration with the department that it was not fulfilling its mission. And so we said that you know, this is not just about how can we come up with ways and thinking about sentencing, because sentencing alone was not going to solve this, sentencing adjustments, but it was also about how are we thinking about real reforms within DJS, real reforms about the ways they're interacting with local law enforcement, making sure that we can get more a greater level of support for local law enforcement. It's the reason that we've introduced legislation this year to get more law enforcement officers on the ground, something called the GAPS Act, which actually focuses on getting more law enforcement officers on board, that we've made historic record investment in local law enforcement and also provided historic investment in not just our state's attorneys across the state, but also Maryland now is unique where we actually help to fund the U.S. attorney who's helping out with prosecutions. And so this really has to be an all of the above approach in the way that we're dealing with justice. And so we'll work with the legislature to come up with something that I know I'll feel comfortable signing as it makes it to my desk. And I'll feel comfortable because we're going to work in partnership to make sure that what makes it to my desk is something that we've worked with them to get done.
And as I mentioned, listeners, we'll talk more about this tomorrow with Delegate Klibinger, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, and Judge Andre Davis about, you know, what the proper and most effective approach, especially because, you know, you mentioned, Governor, the young African-Americans between the ages of 18 and 25. This bill or these bills that they're talking about now in the General Assembly are talking about kids as young as 10 and 11 and 12 year olds. So it's a complicated and and nuanced issue. And as I said, we'll talk more about it tomorrow. Of course, one of the close cousins of crime is poverty. And you have proposed something called the Enough Act, which is an interesting name. It's not an acronym. It's basically you're saying we've had enough when it comes to poverty. And you're talking about neighborhood-based interventions. How would this package of legislation proceed? How would you implement this, and what would you hope to accomplish?
You know, it's amazing because I've come to learn that, you know, every once in a while, my phone will ring in the middle of the night. And whenever it does, it's never good news. And that just happened to happen about 8 months ago when my phone rang in the middle of the night, and it was Mayor Scott. And he told me about a mass shooting in Brooklyn. And, you know, what he told me was where he was waiting on all the details, because at that point it just happened. But he said, the thing that we know is it looks like dozens of people were shot. And he said it looked like many of them were children. And the thing that consistently got me about that, Tom, was, you know, it wasn't just the tragedy, the horrible tragedy of that night. It's the horrible tragedy that has been happening night after night after night before that night even happened, where you know, 1 in 8 children in our state are growing up in poverty. In Brooklyn, the number is 1 in 2 children are growing up in poverty. And so you're right. I said, we've had enough. And enough actually stands for engaging neighborhoods, organizations, unions, governments, and households, basically everybody. And this is going to be a first in the nation approach of actually having a statewide focus on the issue of concentrated and generational child poverty, where we have done some remarkable work in the state just in our first year to focus on the issue of child poverty, being able to focus on things like making permanent the child tax credit, have an enhanced earned income tax credit, raising a minimum wage to $15 and incentivizing work. So we've been able to do a lot to be able to continue to make a dent on the issue of child poverty. Over 160,000 children have been lifted up a rung in the economic ladder. But we've got to address the issue of concentrated child poverty. And these neighborhoods, both in urban, rural, and suburban parts of our state, that have been dealing with this issue for decades. And so what the Enough Act does, it really marshals philanthropy, the private sector, and government resources to be able to take best practices and work with local jurisdictions to be able to come up with the plans. And it's the state, and it's the state in partnership with the philanthropy and private sector that help to marshal the resources, and not the other way around. And so since the best thing you can do to support a child is by making sure that that child is coming up in a strong supportive home, the best way to help that home is by making sure that home exists in a strong supportive community. The Enough Act is really a bipartisan and full front and a full-on assault that the state can help to make. And again, first in the country approach to be able to do place-based investing, to be able to support neighborhoods that historically have been left behind. And so we've introduced that piece of legislation. I personally testified on behalf of the legislation, and we're excited to see the momentum that it has within the legislature, because we're ready to get to work and address this issue of children who are born into poverty have a very high probability of dying in poverty. And that has massive consequences on our state.
And of course, our poorer neighborhoods and areas around the state are the places that often experience the most crime. We have a caller from Glen Burnie, Dan, who left a message on our listener line. He had a question about guns.
This is Dan Dubjakuski from Glen Burnie, Maryland. I would like to ask Governor Moore that since the Bruin decision has come out, I was wondering if it's any chance of us becoming a constitutional carry state in Maryland. Thank you.
And listeners, constitutional carry means you're allowed to carry a gun without a permit. Governor, when it comes to gun legislation, what do you think about Dan's inquiry?
Yeah, no, Dan, I appreciate that question. You know, we came in with a clear focus that we had to address the issue of gun violence in our society. It's one of the leading killers that we have of people in our society. And, you know, we said we've got to be able to address things like getting these illegal guns out of our neighborhoods and off of our streets, that we have to focus on common sense gun laws and basically saying things like, you know, that if a person has a history of mental illness and a history of violence, that person should not be allowed to purchase a firearm. That there's no reason for a person to be able to bring a gun into a nursery or into a government building or into amusement parks, or into homes of worship. That we have to be able to apply a sense of common sense and strategy around it. And that also includes things like you know, legislation that's working its way through that that's making a number of firearm crimes, including the manufacture of ghost guns and illegal guns, making them a felony. Those should not be misdemeanors. So we are going to continue to move to make sure that people in our society are safe, that people can feel a measurement of safety around gun violence, that we understand and respect, you know, people's constitutional rights. And at the same time, we also know that my number one responsibility and my number one commitment is we've got to make sure that people feel safe in their neighborhoods, in their communities, all throughout the state of Maryland.
And I want to move on to another subject. This is the subject of housing. We have a caller from Poppleton, Keisha, who has a question about housing.
My name is Keisha. I am calling from West Baltimore, actually in Poppleton. And my question for Governor Moore is, what is your administration's comprehensive blueprint to address housing as a right for all, namely housing stabilization, increasing the housing inventory, especially affordable housing?
And Governor, you have called what we have in terms of housing here in Maryland a crisis in terms of the shortage of housing, affordable and otherwise. Your response to Keisha's question.
Keisha, thank you so much. And you're right, Tom. I don't use that word crisis lightly. It is. There are a conservative estimate is that we're 96,000 units short in the state of Maryland. And you know, and why that's so problematic is the number one driver of poverty in the state of Maryland is housing insecurity. The ironically, you know, the number one driver of wealth is home ownership. Right. So housing really sits as the barbells of our ability to capture our greatest aspirations or fall into the depths of some of our greatest fears. And another stat that is really important and really sits with me, 30% of young Marylanders are saying they would consider leaving the state because of housing prices. 30% of young Marylanders. And so we knew we had to attack the housing crisis head on. We've actually personally, and I personally testified on behalf of them, we have introduced the most aggressive housing package of any administration in Maryland's history this past year, because we knew that to build a stronger economy, we've got to address the housing crisis head on. And so this session, we introduced a historic package that helps do things like cut through government red tape, when it comes to zoning and permitting and working with local jurisdictions to say that there are places where we know that we should not build. And we understand that. Yet the places where we should build, we should be allowed to build. And we should make it easier for people to be able to build housing and focus on home ownership. That we had to do a better job of protecting our renters. You know, right now, a quarter of all renters will spend 50% of their paycheck on rent. 50% on rent. And so we have to do a better job of protecting our renters. Maryland currently has the lowest eviction filing fee in the entire country. And that's got to change because it allows more people to find themselves in eviction court. And that we knew we had to create greater measurements of and pathways for people to become homeowners, greater supports for first-time homebuyers. And that also includes our unique ability to address the racial wealth gap that we've had, because you know one of the greatest wealth challenges and wealth thefts that we've seen has been historic the unfair appraisal values in historically redlined neighborhoods, and so we put historic capital into appraisal values, and so we know that if we can address the housing crisis, we're not just going to deal with the issue of affordability, which is going to be one of the key goals that we have for this session. But also make sure that more Marylanders know that we are giving them platforms and access and places to come and grow and stay in our state, and ways that we really are going to support this measurement of home ownership and equity within our state. And so the bottom line is that our package is going to save families money, and it's going to create stability in communities. That's the goal, and that's what we have to accomplish this session.
With the Housing Expansion and Affordability Act that's part of this package, you mentioned getting rid of red tape and getting rid of barriers for permits and that kind of stuff. But, you know, state involvement, state government involvement in the private sector of home building and home selling can be a dicey proposition. What is the capacity of the state to incentivize construction of new homes? And of course, when it comes to affordable housing, that's a whole other set of problems. We're seeing this happen and play out in places like Baltimore County. They're under a consent decree to create more affordable housing. And year after year, they get opposition from local neighborhood community associations when they try to get those projects off the ground. What can the state do in a real sense to overcome those kinds of barriers?
Well, I think you're right. Where part of the challenge that we have seen is not much. Now, I do believe that local governments, should be deciding on issues of on issues of zoning, and that's why our proposals have been designed, in communication with local governments and their associations. You know, we've seen that the housing package we pulled together actually has the support of the Maryland Association of Counties and the Maryland Municipal League, places and organizations whose job it is to represent local jurisdictions. Both of them have supported our housing package with amendments. And so broadly, the state does a great job at blocking development in places that we see fit, farmlands, environmentally sensitive zones. But we do a terrible job at incentivizing development and housing where we can and we should build. And so my housing package helps to address this. This is not heavy-handed towards the local jurisdictions. It's actually working hand in hand with local jurisdictions and saying that the state is here to provide measurements of support to address these housing crises, to address the housing shortage, but doing it in partnership with our local jurisdictions.
Governor Wes Moore is my guest today on this midday town hall with the governor. I'm Tom Hall. We will continue our conversation after a quick break. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's a midday town hall with Governor Wes Moore. The governor is answering questions from listeners that we've collected this past week, as well as today. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can drop us a line, midday@wypr.org. So, Governor Moore, I want to talk about the shortage of state workers. When you took office, you noted that the state workforce was down some 10,000 workers, but finding replacements for those workers who've left has proven to be a real challenge. And of course, those challenges result in real live problems. We have a email from Wendy who says, I hear people complaining about accessing services from Health and Human Services like food stamps and mortgage assistance. The website freezes up sometimes, or people fail to pick up the phone or call back. Emily says, I was laid off on January 19th along with four others. Out of the five of us, two are receiving benefit payments and three of us have not. The response time and accountability from the Maryland Unemployment Division has been subpar. I know this is something you've given a lot of thought to, and in your state plan, you talk about metrics and performance calculations that are going to keep tabs on how each department is doing. But where do things stand when it comes to the workforce for the state?
Yeah, thank you so much for those questions. And I tell you, and Emily, what you were saying, it's that frustration is so real. I can tell you, when we came into office, we were facing thousands of vacancies in state government, and more than half of those vacancies were in the executive branch alone. The lack of focus on the basic functioning of governance was staggering. And so when we came on board, we said we've got to be able to address the issue of vacancies, both because there are very real human implications on everything from unemployment insurance to responsiveness in times of crisis, to how we're thinking about parole and probation. But also it was because the people who were working in those jobs, oftentimes they were wearing two and three different hats, because you had the people who were to your right and to your left, they were not in those seats. And so the whole point of bringing on things like a state plan is to add accountability to the basic functionings of governance. And now we're thankful that people have raised their hand, that, you know, we watched for two straight years, there was a net decrease of over 2,200 people that had left state government work, which was adding to that number of vacancies we saw. And just in our first year, we saw a net increase of 1,200 new state employees for this calendar year. So going from a decrease of 22 to increase of 12 in just a 12-month period, we're really thankful that so many remarkable Marylanders have raised their hands to serve. But we also know that we're not done. So while we see momentum, and I was just this morning at DOIT, our Department of IT, and saw that they are now on track for at the end of this fiscal year to have filled all of their vacancies that they had when I first took the oath of office and when Secretary Savage came on board, which is a remarkable turnaround in 18 months for a department. But we also know that we are not done, that we have to get government functioning, we have to get the people in place that can do the work, but then also knowing that we have to modernize our state government. I'm not interested in rebuilding someone else's government. I'm interested in making sure that we have a government that sees and meets people where they are and making sure their needs can be met, that when they call on government, that our government can be responsive.
Governor Wes Moore is my guest. It's our midday town hall with the governor. I'm Tom Hall. Our email, midday@wypr.org. So, Governor, I want to talk about economic development and business development. But first, let me ask you about Camden Yards and next steps there. After some contracts are signed and a few billion bucks changes hands, we'll have a new owner of the Baltimore Orioles. But the issue of how the area around the stadium down at Camden Yards is going to be developed is still to be determined. Do you think that David Rubenstein, as the new owner, is going to approach that particular project in a different way than the Angelos family? And what's your expectation about a plan to develop the area around Camden Yards?
Yeah, I'm thrilled with this new ownership group. We've been in close communication with them throughout. And I'm excited because there is a shared vision that we're not just gonna create winners on the field, but we've gotta create winners off of the field. And we have to make sure that this is gonna be an important part of the larger renaissance that is continuing to take place in the city of Baltimore. I think about why it was so important to get this long-term lease done. Because when I first came on board, and I remember having conversations with the former head of the MSA who was trying to keep his job, and was telling me that, well, I think the best case scenario is a 1-year deal. And I remember saying, you know, thank you and I appreciate it. And as soon as I got off the phone, I called my chief of staff and I said, I want him gone, because we don't share the same vision. We don't share the same vision as to what needs to happen. And so we got, you know, Craig Thompson, who's the new head of the MSA, has just done a spectacular job and known that that we only were going to do a long-term deal. No more 1-year deals, because that leaves a measure and a lack of predictability that's going to be necessary to talk about the long-term growth of an area. We need predictability, and that's what locking in that long-term deal with the Orioles provided. And so we know that when we're thinking about the future, that we continue to see the investments in everything from the convention center to the investments in the West North Avenue Development Authority, to the housing package, to the investments in Harbor Place, to now what's going to take place between both the Ravens and the Orioles. This is a time when, in order for this to be Maryland's decade, it's got to be Baltimore's time. And for it to be Baltimore's time, it means we actually have to have a state that's willing to engage with Baltimore, that's willing to work in partnership with Baltimore. And I'm thrilled that, you know, the momentum that we're continuing to see, Baltimore has the 8th fastest growing economy in the entire country right now. Maryland has jumped 20 slots in economic momentum since we've come on board. The homicide and the violence rates in Baltimore have been the lowest they have been in a decade right now, because we're actually working in partnership with the local jurisdiction, working in partnership with state's attorneys and with the U.S. attorney, working in partnership with community groups. There are cranes all over the place in Baltimore. And so we're thrilled that this measure of momentum that we have to see within Baltimore, it is real. And I'm excited to work with the new ownership group to be able to ensure that the Orioles and the Ravens will be a clear and an important part of that larger build.
And of course, not too far from Camden Yards lies Harbor Place, which is right now very much top of mind for folks here in Baltimore and around the state. David Bramble, a local guy, has purchased Harbor Place. It was in receivership. He's got plans to develop it. Some people are very high on those plans, others very critical. We've gotten a couple of emails from listeners about this. Let me ask you to respond to this one. This is an anonymous email. Person doesn't wish to identify him or herself. The governor has pushed through a new plan for Harbor Place to one of his friends. The process has been secret and undemocratic, and $400 million of public money to support a private company's investment is outrageous. The $400 million is the estimated price tag that the city would spend, or the state, some public entity would spend, revising and changing the traffic patterns around Harbor Place. What's your take on Harbor Place and the design that David Bramble has suggested? It includes, of course, as many as 900 apartment units right on the what is now the Light Street Pavilion, right on the water. A lot of people very concerned about that. But, you know, as you talk about Baltimore's impending renaissance, Harbor Place is certainly going to be part of that. Where do you think things stand?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to acknowledge the clownish comment about the friendship, but I will say this, that, you know, my administration was thrilled to announce the, you know, a $67 million investment to reimagine Harbor Place in Baltimore, that we are going to continue to act with fiscal responsibility. And while at the same time, we are going to work to ensure that the future of this state is at, and future of the city is at the top of minds in investing in decisions that benefit taxpayers and that benefit Marylanders all across the state. You know, this is the state's largest city. And tell me a single state in the country that is clicking on all cylinders when the state's largest city is not. The answer is there is none. And I've looked at the data. In order for Maryland to do what it needs to do, in order for Maryland to thrive, it means the state's largest city must thrive. And that's going to take a shared responsibility from both the local and the state to be able to help to ensure that. And so, you know, we're always going to move with fiscal responsibility. We're always going to move with accountability. And we're also going to move in a way that's actually working in coordination and in partnership with local jurisdictions to ensure that there can be real measurements of economic growth and economic growth that everybody can benefit from and not just some.
Let me ask you about a couple of economic development initiatives. One's called Project Restore, which will give grants to local businesses. The other is called Business Boost, another grant program for small businesses. How do they work, and what do you hope to accomplish?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Boost, Project Restore, you know, that's all ways that we are going to and we will continue to work in partnership and collaboration, because this is not just going to be about state dollars and state vision. This is, how is philanthropy, how is the private sector, how are all sectors of our community actually being involved in the long-term growth? You know, I remember, you know, when I first decided to get in and run for governor, you know, I'd never run for public office before. I was not involved in the political system. I was an Army officer and a combat veteran. I ran a small business in Baltimore, and I ran one of the largest poverty fighting organizations in this country. And the thing that I knew was this, is I don't understand the whole politics as usual thing. I don't plan on learning it. But what I do know is, in order to make Maryland more competitive, we need to have everybody involved and engaged, and we need to have everyone's skin in the game on that. And so that's why initiatives like Boost and Project Restore, that's like work like that we're doing around the Enough Act, where it's actually engaging philanthropy and engaging the private sector in larger community builds. That's why those things become so important, both because it's leveraged capital, but also because it's shared goals.
Let's talk about transportation. The Transportation Trust Fund is, you know, facing some deficits. You and I talked about this a couple of times already since you've been elected. Where do things stand with the prospects for the Transportation Trust Fund? We talked, I think the last time you were here, about, you know, for example, the gas tax. Gas taxes simply aren't as high as they used to be because more people are driving electric vehicles and they don't purchase gasoline. So when it comes to alternative methods of funding the Transportation Trust Fund for things like public transportation, the Red Line, et cetera, what are our prospects in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And, you know, we have a business model that just hasn't worked. You know, and I always say, you know, listen, I'm a business guy, Tom. And you know, if you have a business model that does not work for a decade, it's time to change your business model. And that's exactly what we've had with the Transportation Trust Fund. And I think the legislature knew it when we put together TRIM and we started thinking about ways of being able to look at that Transportation Trust Fund, that TTF, both because we're not the only state dealing with this. I mentioned before that, you know, New Jersey is facing a $1 billion structural deficit. Michigan's at $4 billion. And so states around the country are dealing with this issue. But we also have to have better ways of funding our transportation aspirations. We're the only state in the country that has the state funding two different municipal transportation assets, the only one in the country. And that much of that funding, to your point, came from a gas tax when we're having more and more electric vehicles. And guess what they don't pay? Gas. So we had to update the business model. And that's what we're in the process of doing right now, where being able to invest in long-term projects, things like getting the Red Line back on track in Baltimore, things like being able to complete the Purple Line, which frankly, you know, the way it's been done, where you're now years overrun and billions of dollars overdue, you know, that has just been, it's been a disaster. And so making sure that we can complete the project smartly, complete the project with a real fiscal mind to it and competency, aligned to it became something that was important, but also knowing that we had to be able to get roads and bridges and also these mass transit projects, we have to get them done, but we've got to update the Transportation Trust Fund in order for us to do that. And so that's the kind of responsibility and frankly, the kind of soberness that we are bringing into the debate and bringing into the vision going forward.
Here's an interesting idea from Lawrence, who emails, have you considered using data from Uber and Lyft to see how commuters use them to inform decisions about the Red Line? And what about data from scooter companies like Spin? That's something at least that I've never thought of. But is that the kind of thing that, you and I have talked a lot about data today. Is that the kind of data that could come in handy when it comes to planning things like the Red Line?
That's very useful data, and absolutely, and it's a great point and great question, because all those data points and all those inputs are important. And by the way, those are all things that our Department of Transportation, working in coordination with our state plan, that we're going to be incorporating. One of the things I'm also really proud of is the work that's happened with MTA and the leadership of both Secretary Wiedefeld and people like Holly Arnold have been working closely with community to be able to get insight and feedback about the Red Line. What is the future of the Red Line? What does it look like? And frankly, what do commuters want? And so in very short order, you're gonna see some of the results that we've had in capturing with the countless meetings that we've had with community groups and active community members and local elected officials. And we'll be presenting the path forward that we have on that. But you are right that all of the decisions that we are going to make, they will be data driven, and that kind of input, to include input that's coming from the private sector like Uber and Lyft, that is all useful inputs that we'll make into our decision making process.
All right, Governor, we're going to have to leave it there, but I look forward to the next time. Governor Westmore, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Tom, this is great. Thank you. And thanks to all the listeners, too. I really appreciate y'all.
All right. We'll talk again soon. I hope this is Governor Moore's second legislative session crossover day, when bills migrate from one house to another, is next Monday. And sine die, the final day of the session, is in about a month on April 8th. Thanks for listening to this Midday Town Hall with Governor Moore. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.